over and open it to the commissioners for questions. And Tara is desperate to go.
Thank you. It was all extremely interesting. And
sorry about the knocking. It feels like we're in a Macbeth play. The gate.
So, at the last hearing, we heard about the importance of income, not just in as a factor in access to food, but also access to healthy food. And what I seem to be hearing from this set of, what are you, interviewees, not interviewees, whatever you are,
witnesses,
is that really the problem is that the public health nutrition community, and indeed the environmental community, because I come at this from an environmental angle, all wants everyone to eat like the middle classes. And so I think Hannah was saying that the health agenda, you know, it turns people off because food is framed as, and even access to food is framed in health terms. What you're saying is that there are different sorts of cultural, and in its course it's not just class, it's gender and age and ethnicity, all the rest of it. And then what I think you seem to be perhaps implying is that people who are working class or on lower income and probably by association less educated are therefore more susceptible to unhealthy and damaging food marketing. Okay, maybe you're not saying that, but if there is a correlation between higher income groups and higher levels of educational attainment and better nutritional status, then maybe that's something I'm inferring from what you're saying rather than what you're implying. So I just think this is all really, really interesting, and so a lot of the debate that is that you hear from, if you were reading the Daily Telegraph or the Daily Mail, is that the working classes, they don't want to eat healthily because blah, blah, blah. What you're saying is that it's a cultural phenomenon and that class influences, in a non-judgmental way, influences our patterns of consumption. But it still leaves that question of, if health is desirable because people don't die and it costs the NHS less, and blah, 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 and yet that is a middle-class agenda, and as such it's a form of cultural imperialism, what's the answer?
I think all three of you can have a go at that. Mm-hmm. Wendy first.
I think, you know, you're absolutely right that health or healthy eating is an ideology, really. I mean, it's an ideological position that only some of society currently are able to or do buy into for the range of reasons that we've perhaps pointed out. And it moves away from, I mean, again and again in, you know, various projects, it always comes up, why can't we just talk about tasty food? You know, good food isn't just about health, but it can also be healthy. But, and as Hannah said, you know, this health, calling something healthy, in schools, for example, and with young people, you know, is a barrier, because we all want to eat what we consider nice food, whatever that might be. So I think just the frame of the debate does need shifting away from that, so that we can look at making sure people have access to good food, however that might be defined, and coming at it from a different angle, because it's obviously not working what we're doing, and we are only tapping into the priorities then of certain groups.
I suppose that, so just to clarify my position, because what I'm not saying is that people with less education are more susceptible. I think we are all equally susceptible because this stuff works at an unconscious level. This is why I have massive problem with media literacy as a solution to some of this stuff, because it's effectively building a fence to stop a mold. You're kind of so what's interesting is who are these organisers, who are these brands buying their media against, and how much, and so how much is so, and do you get into a kind of, so I haven't dug into the data, but you could and look at how, where, what media is being bought and put, and where the messages of, that create these norms and endorse these norms go, and who is exposed to that media. So that, do you see what I mean? It's less about somehow saying that I'm above being influenced by this stuff, I'm as influenced by this as anybody, but am I exposed to it as much? maybe not.
And there's a segmentation. I mean, rich people will buy elderflower cordial instead of Coca-Cola. It's got so much sugar in it.
Yeah, exactly. So these problems run across.
And there's also the issue going back to what I was saying about, you know, middle class families or middle class teenagers feeling they're not good enough in terms of health.
So there's a whole another.
So it goes off in a different angle. So they think they shouldn't be buying Coca-Cola and Subway and McDonald's, whereas many of the working class teenagers we spoke to aspire to buying those things but feel they're failed because they can't actually afford them or access them. So it's sort of, you know, there's that impact as well.
And I think part of it, I mean, I segregated the two out in terms of food is seen as health and then why that's problematic, and then the market and consumer side. But actually, obviously, they feed into one another. So one of the reasons it is seen as health is because it's not been seen, or policymakers haven't been kind of upfront about the need to address the fact that some of those markets in terms of the food industry and the labour markets aren't working as in the way that this kind of assumption assumes, if that makes sense. So actually, it's kind of inevitable that health takes over. But it's this aspect that its behaviour is problematic. And I think what's been really important, but listening to the other presentations, is this really understanding what we mean by behaviour and agency, and that it occurs within structures and cultures. And not writing, you know, as Ruth Lister says, not writing agency out, but understanding it occurs within specific contexts and structures. But I think it's, just as Wendy said, what needs to happen is several steps back need to occur, where the problem is reconceptualised as one for a whole range of policymakers, which obviously makes it problematic, and it's why no one's done it that way, because it looks too difficult then. But so that's kind of what I'd say about trying to unpick that kind of health determinant.
Can I just kick back on just two questions and I'll be quiet? So one is the role of the market, or rather the failure of the market, and what you were saying about people would like government to do some of the thinking and some of the choice editing, whatever it is, for them. But there is that notorious gap between what people say and what people do in terms of going to vote, for example. And again, if we're talking about priming, as soon as you mention the word nanny state, you might get completely different set of answers. And the second sort of kickback is up to Wendy about, don't talk about health, talk about good food. But even that, notions of good, if they are so culturally shaped, then, you know, good can be a KFC. And we're back to the kind of, who's good are we going to privilege? So it's not quite an answer. I'm not saying that there is one.
No. No, I don't know if I have an answer for that. But I think it is about reframing it and not setting one set of people up as failing against another set of people, which health does really well. But good is also morally laden and value laden. So it's, that's really difficult.
Without going off on too much of a tangent, just to say briefly, the New Citizenship Project is conceived as basically being about what would it look like to put all the creativity that we currently put into telling ourselves we're consumers to talking to ourselves as citizens and as active participants in shaping the context of our own lives, rather than merely kind of one-dimensional agents. And I think at some level you do have to get most issues come back to that level of going, well, while we conceive of people as consumers, you are the only agency you expect of people is a binary transact or don't involvement, and you're effectively, and the evidence, the sort of tentative evidence from social psychology would suggest that you're telling people to get the best deal for themselves in the short term, measured in material standards of living, rather than, and that is the right thing, that is the morally right thing for them to do. So this does, and this is why I think it's very difficult, because you can't, I don't know where you as a commission want to sit in kind of biting off the world, but it's really interesting that in the start of this Feeding Britain report, the Bishop 10 basically outlines that sort of level of challenge, and then the answer is, let's institutionalise food banks. You're like, so I don't know quite where I would recommend you go with that. My thing would be, I suppose you can't, it's very hard to unpick. It's just that while that is the cultural story, it's pretty interwoven.
Mm. Did you?
Yeah, with the deficit study, I think what would be really interesting is to go back now, because a couple of the things, I mean, DEFRA funded us at that time to do that piece of work on food price rises and consumer reactions because of the spikes there have been in food price rises just previously. But obviously the whole food bank question wasn't on the agenda then. And likewise with the New Deal for Community thing, there was a sense that, a bit like exactly like you were saying, you know, the practitioners in the industry partnership were saying it wasn't high enough up the list. People were worried about crime. People were worried about all these other things. So I'd like to kind of go back now. And my hunch would be that some of this, in terms of what consumer citizens think the role of government would be, probably, I imagine, would be maybe even stronger. And certainly, I think some of the things I said about retailers, because that was quite interesting as well, the sense that there was a real cynicism about the role of retailers. So what we asked them to do in the workshops was, we said, whose responsibility are various aspects of food security? And government came up, you know, at the top for most of them, because they felt it was government's responsibility to ultimately protect people, you know. And they had huge cynicism around the role of retailers because they were motivated by profit. So the idea was that government was having to step in. That was different by different income groups, because we sampled the focus groups according to different income groups and stuff. According to DEFRA's environmental mapping thing, I can get it out, it was very complicated. But and you did see occasionally, because consumers were one of the people we said who's responsible for, termed consumers, and occasionally a few people from the higher income groups did say, oh, well, consumers can, we do have buying power. But as soon as you were going further down the kind of income scales, people said, we don't have any power by definition. We've got no money, and we can't do anything really. So that was a really interesting finding from us, considering we were, you know, funded by government, coming with all these policy documents that really emphasised the role of consumers in shaping the market, and actually these consumers themselves were saying that's just not true. I think one thing that might be interesting is to go back and actually map, kind of, because I've been doing quite a lot of work on food rights and the right to food. And if we ask those questions of responsibility, and particularly government's role in terms of, you know, the human rights kind of idea of respecting, protecting and fulfilling, and actually how people view the government's roles in those different angles, that might be different, particularly in the context of food banks, you know, in terms of people feel that...
But kind a government of, intervention might alter the price of food in ways that are not in keeping with the cultural identities itself. Communities.
Yeah.
I'm going to offer other people a chance to come in. Do you, Neil or Chant?
I've got so many questions, I'm trying to get them all. If this is about access to good food and kind of about behaviour, then for me the kind of opening question really is, who decides what access to good food is, and who decides what good food behaviour is? And there's both who actually decides that, but actually I want to hear some ideas about what you think it might be. Also on the assumption that there was no kind of halcyon past when, because that's the risk, that it's all just need to go back to something. And assuming that both of those are different from what we've got now, otherwise we wouldn't really be here. What is then the role of markets in providing it? Because food's always been supplied by markets. Whether or not I'll go for the consumer thing, food, other than in schools and food banks, has always been supplied by markets of one kind or another. So what is their role? And then the third one's what the role of government, because a government has never really intervened in the food retail. Its interventions have been elsewhere. And is there a case for banning the advertising of bad food in the way that cigarettes? You know, if we're saying that bad advertising actually creates detriment, then why do we permit it?
So it's really that's a really helpful question for me. So, just briefly, the story I would tell of the sort of role of the individual in society. I tend to think of it in a kind of in a shift from subject to consumer and potentially to citizen. So I'm using those terms with caveat. But if you think so, and so the year 1984 is really interesting. In 1984, Apple launched the Macintosh. Apple kind of launched the world, and the ad that they did that with was the most famous ever made, and it was kind of. And basically what they were saying was the consumer is in charge now. You don't, if you want a computer, you don't have to just, there is more than one choice, there is the consumer rules. And that was framed as sort of, the ad was basically a takeoff of Orwell's 1984, where it was kind of, it was basically saying Big Brother's gone now, and you're in charge. And later that year, Virgin Atlantic launched, Body Shop floated on the stock exchange, Band-Aid was that year. And it's a really fascinating year of kind of we can the consumer power can solve the world's problems and from what came before. So to put that into your framing, I would say arguably there's a phase where kind of some higher ivory tower of wisdom made the decision about what we should eat. Then the idea was that the consumer was a higher level of freedom than that, and that would enable us to shape what we ate and what good food was, among other things. But that's led to a kind of over dominance of the market, and because the framing of us within that market is a moral idea of us as get what you want right now, rather than a kind of more empowered. And I think what's possible now is actually not about, I wouldn't say the answer is that government should decide what good food is. I would say the answer is that we should decide what good food is. And I think that is possible. But I think and that's the sort of emerging idea of the concept of the citizen. It's an active participant in shaping these things, not rather than waiting for either government or market to kind of do it to us or for us. That brings me to why I would say that the most important thing you could do on advertising is less about brand-specific food advertising, because that's a government intervention in the market. It's more about can we limit where advertising is in our lives so that we have oxygen to breathe, to think of ourselves as something other than consumers, so that when we try and appeal to people to take part in these conversations, the sort of the background noise of your consumers, your agency, it's the buy stuff, isn't so overpowering. There's one ad that I would deeply recommend you look at. It's an ad called Follow the Frog made by the Rainforest Alliance, which many people in the environmental movement in particular talk about as this wonderful thing. To me, it's the worst thing that's ever been done. The story of it effectively is that someone decides they're going to go into the rainforest and gets worried about the rainforest, decides they're going to go into it and help it, and then basically makes a fool of himself. And the resolve is, don't try and solve the world's problems. Just buy Rainforest Alliance products. Shush, little person. Just go shopping. That's your role here. And that to me is the systemic level at which you have to kind of, if you're really going to get there.
So. What does that mean for low-income citizens? How can they actually shape?
I think that we're coming into the age of the internet fully dawned. I think it is feasible and I think it is possible to design a process where people can genuinely get involved in that debate, and I think people would want to if we weren't telling them that that's not their role constantly.
But why would they bother getting involved in it? What does a debate, how does a debate change?
Well, if there's power to it, then it can. I mean, I think.
No, power over what? Is it power over the state? Is it power over the market?
Both, potentially. I mean, this is a kind of. I don't know exactly. I can't tell you exactly how it would work. But I think that's theoretically, at least, that is the answer. How do we facilitate a process whereby we can actually. So, I mean, look at, for example, the Better Reykjavik initiative in Iceland, where people are actively participating in the legislature of the city of Reykjavik. Look at the Podemos movement in Spain. Look at Partido La Red in Argentina. These are things where you have deliberative processes being facilitated, and we're only now experimenting with it, right? Like, we don't know exactly how this stuff is going to happen, but that's, I would argue, that's the transition that we are at least potentially entering.
Thanks. Anyone else want to come back? So Wendy, and then
a few points to do with markets and marketing, actually. And Neil, you said, you know, most mainly there are markets apart from in the schools and food banks, for example. But actually, I think schools are a really interesting example because the food environment around schools, well, on all high streets, you know, isn't just made up of all the sort of branded chain outlets and branded food and drink products. And I think this is a sort of enduring question in my head, is to do with the foods that aren't marketed, you know, the sort of fried chicken shops and the, or just the local bakers, you know, not a chain bakers, and the food and drinks that are available in those, they're not marketed in the same way, and yet they're inherently popular. And from what I've noticed in lots of studies of going around schools and local environments, you know, young people are aware that they are a consumer in those environments around schools and that their custom is valued, and they are quite canny as to where they spend the money that they've got and what they want to buy with it, and that they don't always want to buy the branded products. Again, sometimes they sort of see that in a separate realm, I think, in terms of, you know, when I have the money or if my mum's buying it for me, rather than the money that the food that they're going to buy there, spend their money on. And I'm always fascinated that in schools, young people are not viewed as customers and consumers on the whole. I mean, I know their money's important to them, I know, Gina, but and in terms of wanting to keep them in schools, but I think there's a huge amount that we can do in terms of promoting still more, I know lots has been done, the food available in schools to attract young people as consumers and customers, although I take the point about not always seeing people as consumers, but, and it still astonishes me that we still, lots of schools still don't ask young people what they want to eat. Some do, and some do it brilliantly. And we still don't offer, you know, going back to the point about good food or tasty food, and the example in your working paper that you circulated, Cameron, about, you know, the boxed chicken initiative, I thought was fantastic, because that was about offering tasty food that young people want to eat, but in a slightly healthier way, but not taking away from the main reason why people, not just young people, people want to buy fried chicken or chips or whatever it is. You know, and I think markets is an idea that, you know, that you said should governments intervene in sort of retail sector or the food. Again, it's a bit sort of pouring a thimble of water on a fire that you can't put out, that how much can you regulate really the kind of outlets that are available around schools? And actually, you can't, you know, people assume it is the sort of takeaway outlets that are the ones that are the worst, but lots of young people shop at the supermarket near a school and are buying equally unhealthy products as they are at the sort of, you know, the one-off fried chicken shop.
So that's something really interesting you said there is when did we ask what do you want to eat? And that in itself, that asking that question of people would be treating them as something other than a consumer, because you wouldn't just be deciding. So, I mean, maybe that's a partial answer to your question. Maybe kids having agency in deciding what they are eating would be a really interesting thing to do. I mean, if you look, there's a gang that I'm doing some work with called the Phoenix Democratic Education Trust, who I want to rename to start with. But the core idea there is about when you give children agency in how they are, how their own education works, you empower a future citizen, because you give the experience of having agency rather than training a future consumer. So that,
Interesting. Yeah, just a couple of thoughts, Neil, on focusing on what you raised. In terms of the question of access to good food and who defines it, I think it's a really interesting question. I think actually this, the whole notion of good food is quite interesting. And from my work, I think how I would say it is actually that people should have access to socially acceptable food experiences. And that's not necessarily about opening up a shop around the corner from my house that just sells apples and vegetables. That's actually about me being able to shop and cook and eat like anyone else in our society would expect to do. So I think there's access to a whole food experience, and to actually be able to make the choice to not buy the apple but to buy the, you know, chocolate bar instead. And I think there's some interesting things around that, and actually maybe by talking a lot about good food, we're reasserting that whole health diet, you know, discourse that we've just problematised so hugely. So I think that's probably one thing I'd do, take a step back and talk about food experiences rather than good food. I think actually, which is something that the others were just talking about, is actually involving the people whom we're talking about as well. And I think I've moved away from the, obviously, regeneration research leaving the centre at Coventry. But I think, you know, revisiting some of those place-based ideas, I think, is also quite important. I mean, and I saw a paper that the minimum income standards team did experimenting with the idea of a minimum place standard. I don't know if they ever published that work. I'll have a look and see if I can forward it on to you, because there was talk about access to services in shops was part of that. And also the idea that access to shops, it's not just access to one shop, but this whole idea a lot of people shop around and things like that, so it's actually access to a lot of shops and having the same choice and accessibility as everybody does. I think the other point you raised about not talking about housing passes is also really important, and I think the participants in the research for the New Deal for Communities really did a good job of checking me on that, because they said, well, you know, this isn't just about the 10 years of this initiative. It's actually about a longer term decline of what our community is like. And so there is something about that and reimagining that. In terms of the role of the markets, I think other points have been made have been excellent. I think the only thing I would add there is actually that I think some of the thinking around rights can help us here. So there was a really good paper that I read recently on the right to housing. It was done in Scandinavia, housing policy. And actually there he talked a lot about how you would justify intervening in the housing market in relation to the right to housing. And I think actually we can learn quite a lot from other work on sort of the right to health and the right to housing as well. And again, if you know, you might be talking about different types of market-based interventions depending on what aspect of the right you might be talking about. So fulfilling, for example, would be a whole, fulfilling the right to food would be a different set of interventions to protecting it, for example. And also a lot of people would say that the market's been quite successful in driving prices down as well, you know, in the last couple of years and things like that. I don't study that side of things, so I'm not going to say that, and you know, my work has all been most recently about the rises again, but so I think it's, you know, it's an interesting one.
Jeanette, would you like to raise anything?
Well, Neil's asked three of mine. the one word that I found interesting, I thought there were three presentations were really good, but the one word that I found wasn't anywhere was education. You know, we need to educate these guys, do we or not? But and education has not been spoken about at all. Food and education, to me, go together.
I'll say something more.
Yeah.
I think we have to accept that people, especially young people, think of it again now, but people already do have a lot of knowledge. But then there is a different kind of education, I think, that perhaps we should be offering to, again, particularly young people, in terms of the possibilities to do with different types of food, for example. And I mean, again, I mean, I'm sure you have been in lots of schools where some young people have a very narrow field of experience in terms of the type of foods that they've eaten. And I know I've met lots of kitchen supervisors in schools who are very frustrated that they can't give different types of food to young people because it's just so alien to what they've had. But I think there must be a way of doing that in a different way, of using sort of local food suppliers, but on a sustainable, long-term basis, not some initiative that lasts 6 weeks and then everybody wonders why they suddenly haven't changed the kind of food they're eating. So it puts the emphasis back on the individual young person, I think. But you know, some kind of sustainable educational initiative, a bit like Food for Life does do very well in some schools, in order to educate, but not in a top-down, pouring knowledge in kind of way, because I think it doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, I think, for me, I'm very wary of it because of all the points I raised in terms of the community-based interventions that tend to focus on that side, and exactly like Wendy just said. I think as long as it's universal and every child in the whole country is, or you know, young person is engaged within it, then that's, you know, that's fine. But unfortunately, I think only too often it gets seen synonymously with poverty and poor people. I mean, this is a perfect example of it, isn't it? Baroness Jenkins there.
Nice.
Yeah. So not Kate. Baroness Jenkins. So I think, you know, so that's why I'm always very wary of it, because I think too often it gets seen as something that just affects one type of demographic. But this is a much broader commission and a much broader set of agendas around, you know, culture generally, everybody's culture. So I think, you know, that's fair enough.
I suppose what I'd say is I think that everything I talked about is about education. I think education isn't
isn't just formal education. Education is what we're what is the stories we surround ourselves with about who we are and what our lives are for. And so my contention would be that while you only think of education as rational sort of conscious intervention in a formal school setting, you're missing the fact that we're telling people exactly the opposite as soon as they walk out onto the street and see what's encouraged by starting what they're encouraged to be. So I think Food for Life is great, and I know it well, and I know Helen and the Soil Association, and I would love to I mean, maybe link up with Phoenix Education and do something about what say the kids have and what they and how they get more involved in participating rather than just eating. But I think there's what I would say is I don't think you can. I think the model that if the theory of change were to be expose kids to healthy eating and then they will take it forward, I think you have to realise that there's an awful lot of other influences that are saying that's not. Here's a different conception of what good food is that's competing with that. Does that make sense?
Interestingly, you've used healthy eating.
Yeah. Or good food, or whatever.
Yeah, not good
use.
Food.
Yeah.
Healthy eating. And my other, what I was thinking about was what would, and we seem to be putting these working class, middle class, I don't like that.
No.
I don't like the class system at all. I understand it's there, but I'm just thinking, what would, if you've got three sets of people sat here, what would they think of what we're talking about this morning?
I think...
From people, the poor class, the working class.
I think they would say, why is no one asking me what I think?
I
think it does come back to that.
It's just really
going assume,
through.
And then it's just such an obvious thing that why aren't we asking more people what they think and finding solutions that are socially acceptable, culturally acceptable, give people the right to tasty, a good food experience or whatever you want to call it, but... You know,
to me, it's quite an arrogant assumption.
Yeah,
but that's what I think. I think that is the frame of the consumer that does that to us.
Yeah.
The language that we think of, that is used to describe in the newspapers, all of us actually, and we might sort of make it the other of a lower class, but the we assume. That there is an assumption that what the right thing is to do is decide what consumers should be choosing between, rather than to offer citizens the ability to participate in shaping what the choices are. And I think that's a massive paradigm shift that is starting to happen.
And you could argue, why isn't there a member of the public on this commission? I mean, I was just sitting here thinking that in my department, for example, which is the Centre for Research in Primary and Community Care, we don't have any group or any project that doesn't have members of the public sitting on it, and we have a pool of people and we train them so that they know what's going to happen at meetings and so that they can take part and understand about research, and we never undertake anything without them involved. And yet when it comes to food or possibly, and I'm not criticising the commission, so this is a great thing to have, but you know, we do need to be involving people and asking them, not assuming.
We had that discussion right at the beginning, definitely.
And we made a decision to seek further funding to have an expert group, which are people who are members of the public dealing with food and poverty issues, which Neil's group has convened in Manchester. We made the first meeting on Thursday, and what they said is now will be up online on the Commission website shortly. I'd like to raise a few questions in a minute, but then I'd like to offer the opportunity for those of you who've come to raise any questions you have. I'll ask you to do it one after the other, not individually, so that we gather them and then our witnesses can respond to any concerns that you may have. Listening to the different things, I'm just going to go through the thoughts that occurred, some of them that occurred to me listening. I mean, Hannah, you're very strongly saying don't equivalent food and health. This is a problem if we are thinking food's all about health. I was thinking too about Incredible Edible Todmorden and the Incredible Edible movement, which is not about being a consumer but being about an active citizen and actually not asking permission, just going ahead and doing things and connecting people in a different way. And you'd mentioned something about different levels of action. I'd certainly like to see that either here or later unpacked. What levels of action are we talking about? By whom? To whom is that directed? And it's clear that place and transport are intimately connected, and that varies between rural and urban. On the shifting you know, social things shape. Jeanette and I were having a discussion before this meeting started. We come from a generation which had very different attitudes, and we were brought up, I think, with very different attitudes to a lot of the current generation and the younger generation now. And so there's an intergenerational shift that's gone on. And it's probably also strongly linked to what you were saying, John, about the whole, you know, there was no TV before the age of... There was no commercial television when I was tiny. And now by the age of five, a child can identify more brands than anything else, I think. And so we've got a very different world that's changed, and we need to unpack and understand that. And I think you've been very helpful in taking us down some of that line. And you're saying it's not individuals that shape eating practices. A lot of different things do, your family, your peer group pressures, but this whole environment in which you're dropped on, when you, almost from the moment you come out of the womb. Well, it is, because you get the beauty pack, the packs, don't you, when the mother comes out of hospital. So you've got those kind of things. And again, you talked about, I think, Wendy, you talked about the hierarchy of needs, and then we had John talking about, let's get rid of this Maslowian hierarchy of needs. I think we need to unpack something about what we see as needs and wants, and wants are unlimited and needs are... I quite like Manfred Max Neef's approach to needs, that are actually not very many of them, yeah, and you can meet them relatively easily, but you can't do it by just feeding someone them.
But also there are pseudo-satisfiers.
And there are things that appear to satisfy one need but actually undermine other needs. So I think it would be nice to get you to pull a bit more out of that. And I think, Wendy, also you talked about income being only one aspect of poverty, and I think one of the issues we do want to try and get to is food and poverty and the connection between them. And poverty is a bigger thing than just about income, aspiration and other things, so it would be quite useful to kind of pull out a bit more from you. How do you look at the rest of those issues? And I thought it was a very interesting comment about the obesogenic environment affecting what you feel about your weight and the dangers we have today of new norms becoming norms that are actually really dangerous for both people, and I think you'd say, Tara, as well, for the consumption patterns on the viability of the environment. One question I wanted to ask you, John, was my recollection, and from a meeting I went to with a historian, was that advertising took off in, I think, the 1850s when the tax on advertising was lifted. Is it time to think either of an equal and opposite earth time, if we wanted to say anyone, you can choose, well, there's an equal advertising time for this and that, so you'd have a 50% tax on advertising for bad stuff, so it went to the good stuff, or that we should actually say we should actually constrain advertising and marketing. I think I'd like you to come down a little more clearly on what you actually think would make sense. One of the people who you probably know, Gerard Hastings, the director of the Institute for Social Marketing, wrote in an article in the BMJ, the marketing campaigns of multinational corporations are harming our physical, mental and collective well-being. Is that something you agree with? And if so, what elements would you say we should be starting to do about that? And when you were talking to Wendy before, was it about these, you know, around a school, there's lots of different places. I was going back to the point that you made, I think, about category advertising. If anybody advertises deep fried chicken, does that benefit everybody who sells deep fried chicken? Because it creates the fence that this is what I should be having. So we can't think of advertising in a very narrow sense about being the particular. And what has happened? Is there any work that tells us more about how infants and children, when they actually start going to school, think about the world and what they should be consuming, given the fact that they're likely to have been? And I saw it I ate in a restaurant last night, and two people eating, and they put up a little phone with a cartoon on for the child to watch while they were eating. This is, you know, a huge change. So I think we'd like to have much more, if you can, not necessarily now, but point us to some more about thinking about this. And finally, on the right to food, we are a signatory of the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, which includes elements of the right to food, and we're a member of the Food and Agriculture Organization, which has produced guidelines on achieving the right to food. I think it would be nice to know a bit more about what things you would think could be done and should be done in a UK context. And the Brazilian Ministry of Public Health, for example, has also just made an interesting link between the types of food that we see the most advertising and the types of food that should be avoided. Are there things we should be learning from other countries? And I don't mean just other rich countries, from actually other countries in different parts of the world, about how we think about this. So those are the things, some of the things I'd like either a quick response for now or subsequent to this hearing. Any quick response, and then I'll offer the floor to the other members here who may have a question.
I should respond on the hierarchies of need issue, because actually I'm just sitting here racking my brain, and I think in our papers it probably wasn't hierarchies of need, it's hierarchies of risk and worry, because we were conscious of not getting into the whole Maslow sort of model, because what we were looking at were those everyday experiences, those risks and worries were on an everyday basis, rather than those kind of more fundamental things in Maslow's hierarchy. So just to clear that
up. So you're saying that if I'm worried about the risk of my child getting injured going out, I'm not going to, that's my priority. Yes. I'm not going to be too bothered about these other things at the moment.
That's at that moment, you know. Although overall, you know, parents do are concerned about that.
Balancing those differences.
Yeah. Yeah. I should probably land. So I would land on the side of we need restrictions on all. On where advertising is in our lives, regardless of who it's from and for, partly because I think that to draw the line between what is good and what is bad is very, very difficult, and also partly because the reason why I am advocating that is because it's at the level of what is the dominant identity construct of the individual in society, and while advertising is as ubiquitous and as prevalent as it is in our lives, and increasingly so, the space to be something other than a consumer is contracted, and that's the critical thing.
And by advertising, you include everything to do with marketing, is that right?
Yes.
Thank you.
I just sort of quickly say, when you're saying about my point around not putting food and health as synonymous, I think I know a lot of public health researchers who do amazing work on this, and I know a lot of public health practitioners that do are trying to do some really, you know, big vision thinking. So that's not to criticise anyone in the kind of health sector or health research. I think that's based on what's gone before, largely, and what you can trace is, you know, it's seen as health, and then this happens, and then this happens, and it's little projects that are the response. So if what health is can be reconceptualized in that same way, then maybe it's not such a bad thing. But I think it's got to be seen as an issue that is covered by lots of different structures. And on the right to food things, I won't say anything more now, but my thesis ended up being all about food rights, so I can send you bits and
Pick out bits, please.
Not the entire thesis.
I just want to add one tiny thing to that thing about limits on advertising. The reason I say that, or part of the thing that I want to make clear, is I think actually that is, and I've had these conversations with people in the advertising industry, I do not think advertising is per se an evil thing. I think it has a role in a healthy society, but I think there need to be boundaries where it is in our lives. If that is the case, then I think there is. And I think that would actually be in the interest of the advertising industry. And just to your thing about lessons from other countries, when outdoor advertising was banned in Sao Paulo, the creative director at DDB Brazil came out and said he thought it was a really good thing, partly because it set the boundaries around where advertising could be and created a greater legitimacy for the industry.
So you think actually it could be something if there are clearer boundaries that the industry might extend?
Certain parts of the industry. I think it could be in there.
On the question of health, the WHO definition of health, which I think we're all signed up to as members, is health as a state of complete physical, mental and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. And in that framework, I think a lot of what you said is really important about that. Because one of the points that was made to us in the group that we talked about last week is about the feel-good factor in food. I want to enjoy it. I want to feel good about it. And if I'm just constrained to eating this narrow thing, I'm not going to be able to. I can't celebrate my birthdays with me, whatever. Yeah, so right. there's a whole range
of. Cavalry does give joy in some circumstances.
So those are things. Now, those of you who've joined us today, thank you for coming. If you'd like a question, please say who you are and what you'd like to ask the witnesses to comment on.
Well, are you looking at me?
So I'm looking at you. Well, you look as though you had a question ready.
My name's Anna Glazer. I actually run the food programme at Consumers International. So we're quite constrained with consumer definition. And I came along, it's been fascinating. Thank you very much for all the good presentations. One of